They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Radio Fairfax. Joining us today, we have Dr. Bonner Cohen. Dr. Cohen is a senior fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research, a position he's had since 2002. He's also a senior policy analyst with the Committee for Constructive Tomorrow and the author of The Green Wave. Bonner, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You also have been very active in property rights?
Yes, I have. This goes back, at least 20 years, 20 to 25 years. If you look at the problems that ordinary Americans face, and this is a long laundry list, that includes everything from a middle class that is not nearly doesn't have nearly the standard of living that it had a few decades ago. You have terrible public schools. You have government regulations which are frankly designed to put clamps on entrepreneurship and businesses and the formation of businesses. It's a long list. And you also have environmental policies that were enacted, many of them around 40 years ago, which turned out to be not what they were advertised to be, but rather instruments by which primarily the federal government, often in league with environmental groups, crony capitalists of every possible persuasion and others, can impose their particular view of the world on the rest of us, and that invariably leads into all sorts of policies that interfere with, undermine, and in some cases all but nullify property rights. And this is across the board, everything from the way the Endangered Species Act is enforced. This is primarily an issue in the western United States, but believe me, it's coming east, to policies that use the federal government, in some cases the state government, and in many, many cases local governments in league with environmental groups impose restrictions on, or land use restrictions, on primarily rural, but not just rural, areas of the country, which ultimately come at the expense of property owners. So this is a very broad spectrum of different measures that are taken. They're generally taken in the name of doing something that sounds awfully good. Now that can be, well, we need do away with traffic congestion, or we need to preserve the character of a certain community or a certain part of the country. We need to protect wildlife. We need to protect this, protect that. All sounds very, very good until you dig a bit deeper and you find out that in the name of doing something good, which frequently serves as little more than the pretext, a completely different agenda hides, and that agenda is something that directly affects property owners around the country.
Are these unintended consequences, or are these pretty much determined beforehand?
They're determined beforehand. A lot of people think they are unintended. They think, well, my God, that was a great idea, but we didn't really think it through, and we now see that we are at a place where we didn't intend to be. Well, that depends on who the we is. Because the people who are ultimately behind so many of the rules, regulations, laws, and what have you, and we can get into those in a minute. I've already mentioned the Endangered Species Act, but I could just as easily have mentioned the Clean Water Act, and we'll definitely get to that before we're done. The people who wrote those laws wrote them the way they did for a reason, because they recognized that once these bills have been signed into law, then a whole set of events was going to be set in motion that would, in fact, have consequences that very few people outside of those writing the laws could have foreseen at the time, but which are now apparent to an awful lot of people. The people who did this, the people who wrote the laws, the people who supported the policies, had a pretty good idea where this was going to go. The people on the receiving end of that, and many of the lawmakers, whether they were in the Congress of the United States, really had absolutely no idea what it was that they were signing off on. So they, well, here's the Clean Water Act, or here's the Safe Drinking Water Act, or here's the an Endangered Species Act. Sounds great. Nobody bothered to read the fine print, and nobody realized, or very few people did, where this particular journey was going to go. And we are now saddled with the consequences of that. So to get back to your question, were the unintended consequences? Certainly not from the standpoint of those who were behind all of this. There were innocent bystanders along the way, people who, shall we say, bought into this, in the mistaken belief that so many of these things that sound so good would, in fact, lead to something good, but they have, in fact, led to something that's not good at all.
So we're talking about the special interests who've actually written the laws, lobbied to get them passed, and the elected representatives who are supposed to be looking out or representing their constituents are not really doing their homework, and they're going, oh yeah, okay, we'll just sign up on it. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, that's certainly what happened when the initial national environmental laws were enacted, the vast majority of them in the early 1970s under the Nixon administration. And most members of Congress said, well, this certainly looks good, and we had more serious environmental problems then than we have now. The air wasn't as clean then as it is now, nor was the water. It was something relatively sophisticated, certainly technological sophisticated society such as the United States should address, and indeed already was addressing, but it became politically fashionable to nationalize the whole problem, which in my view was a huge mistake. And in so doing, laws were passed with little thought given by those who actually voted for these laws as to where the journey would eventually lead.
What's the answer? Is there no way of going back and undoing them, or has too much happened since
then?
Well,
I'll tell you what needs to be done. So many of the problems that we face today with regard to all the rules and regulations that are being imposed upon us, not just in the property rights sector, but in various sectors of business and industry and what have you, all arise from what we can call the administrative regulatory state. Now, that's a big term, but what does it mean? Every law that is passed in this country, every environmental statute, for instance, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, what have you, these various statutes contain standards. They contain rules. They contain regulations. Well, as it happens, those rules, regulations, and standards can be amended, and they can be amended by the agencies imposing them. Thus, when the Environmental Protection Agency decides that it wants to expand its power, and this does go straight to the property rights issue, and it wants to declare a whole bunch of bodies of water to be under their jurisdiction, they are doing so not by having the Clean Water Act amended by Congress, but rather issuing rules and regulations themselves. Each rule and regulation that is promulgated by the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, has the force of law behind it, which means that EPA, as well as other federal regulatory agencies, have become, contrary to what was foreseen in the Constitution, and contrary to what we are taught should be the case, they have become lawmaking bodies. In other words, they are effectively making laws because every rule and regulation has the force of law behind it. Congress, for the past 75 years, has been, for the most part, neutered in this. It can step in if it so chooses, but for the large part, has refused to do so. The consequences have been that you have federal regulatory agencies, which now have an enormous amount of power, one which completely undermines the whole concept of divisions of powers, checks and balances. There are very few checks and balances on EPA. EPA bureaucrats do pretty much what they want. So, unless the whole structure of the regulatory administrative state is attacked head on, you're going to continue to be living in a country where unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats will have an enormous say over how you live your life. Let me give you an example. I mentioned this briefly earlier. The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, has teamed up with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and issued a set of regulations, or they proposed a set. They have not yet been officially issued, but they proposed a set of regulations under the name of Waters of the United States. Now, what does that refer to? Under the Clean Water Act, EPA is charged with regulating discharges of pollutants into navigable waters of the United States. Well, I think we all have a pretty good idea what we mean when we hear the term, what is meant when we hear the term navigable waters. These are, you know, rivers, bays, things like that, channels, where ships, commercial, or for that matter, even recreational boats, go. They are, in fact, navigable. EPA has been trying for decades to expand that definition to include non-navigable waters of the United States, which could be ditches, puddles. In certain parts of the country, you have depressions that fill up, and this is particularly true, say, in the upper Midwest, that fill up when the snow melts after a long, severe winter. When the snow melts, these depressions fill up with water. They're called prairie potholes in North Dakota and South Dakota, where these things are. And they remain wet. They are thus wetlands for certain parts of the year until the sun comes out over the summer and dries them up. EPA is now claiming jurisdiction over all these bodies of water, and it is doing so by effectively removing the term navigable from the term waters of the United States, meaning that EPA can regulate just about everything it chooses, any body of water on your property. The interesting thing about this is the consequences for the landowner. Now, the landowner we're talking about could be a farmer, it could be a rancher, or it could be someone who has a tree farm, a fruit orchard, or something like that. But this will also eventually make its way into suburban landowners with plots of land. If you want to do something on your property that changes that property in a certain way, you can add a garage, or you want to make an addition to your home, and if EPA in its infinite wisdom determines that you have a body of water on your property, even if that body of water is only temporary. And even if that body of water doesn't even, say there's a creek in the back of your property, and even if that creek dumps into another creek, which dumps into another creek, which dumps into another creek, which goes into a river, the river is navigable, you get the point. They will use that as an excuse to regulate your land. What this means is that in the name of protecting water bodies in the United States, or bodies of water, EPA is effectively now engaged, or will be engaged, in land use control. For the landowner wishing to do something on his or her property, it's going to mean that rather than going to your county or your state to get a permit, if in fact what you were going to do required a permit, you're now going to have to go to EPA. Now, there are many things you don't want to do in your life, and one of them is to go to EPA for a permit. First of all, it's going to take a month of Sundays before they eventually get around to it. Secondly, if EPA, for whatever reason, denies you the permit to do whatever it is that you think is in your interest or you would like to do on your property, and denies you the permit, what recourse do you have? Answer, absolutely none. So if there was ever a threat to property rights, and I think it's currently one of the biggest threats to property rights, it is unquestionably the administrative regulatory state embodied in the way in which EPA conducts its affairs, and that it issues rules and regulations completely disregarding the separation of powers between the executive and the legislative and the judicial branches of government, imposing its particular will on people around the country, and effectively introducing a system of federal zoning throughout the country. Jeez. And believe me, this is exactly where they want to go. They are working hand in glove here with environmental groups. Many of the people who, particularly in the Obama administration, are the political appointees to the EPA, they were all drawn from the likes of the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, Sierra Club, Environmental Defense Fund, the usual suspects. And there's kind of a revolving door between the green groups and EPA. And all of these people are washing each other's hands. EPA regularly provides grants to these groups. So it's a very incestuous relationship. The environmental groups provide the propaganda in support of whatever it is that EPA is proposing to do, and EPA expands its powers. So coming back to where we started, what the big threat here to the landowner is the landowner's inability, or will be the landowner's inability to do anything about this to protect his property rights once EPA has given itself the power to regulate land use on plots of land that can be everything from a backyard where you have a barbecue right up to a tree farm someplace, or a fruit orchard, or what have you. Believe me, these threats are real, and they are coming to you courtesy of Washington, D.C.
You know, Bonner, we know about this smart growth, and we seem to be crowding people in, and lots are getting smaller and smaller, and of right. course we have privatized governments in the form of homeowners associations.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
I live in a high-rise condo in Arlington, Virginia. I can tell you all about, I pay a condo fee, I know all about that.
You know all about that. Yeah, well, yeah. If you lived in, I mean, anywhere you go, anytime a developer comes in and starts building, they are now required to provide these drainage ponds. It's just an indentation where the rain gathers, because they don't want all that water going into the Chesapeake Bay. And so virtually every property that's built, not individual property, because we no longer have individual properties, we have collective properties.
Right.
And that's another layer that's gone.
Right.
So now you're saying that that's sort of an open invitation for the EPA to come in and start regulating. And so whether you apply for anything or not, whether you try to do anything just by the virtue of being in one of these associations, you are subject to all their cockamamie rules and regulations.
Oh, yeah. The people who assume positions in these homeowners associations are kind of power-hungry people. We run into them all the time.
Yeah.
And they're generally very petty people. A lot of them are drunk with power, and they have this little empire. They're this, it's a little fiefdom. It may just be 100 or even 50 or 40 homeowners, but by God, they're running the show there. And they have their particular view of how things should go, and they will come up, as you said, with every imaginable cockamamie rule or regulation, and woe betide the homeowner who bucks his homeowners association. Then you're in a big fight. That can lead to litigation, which is going to cost the homeowner a lot of money, as I'm sure many of our listeners who have been fortunate enough to have gone down that road know. And you frequently find that these homeowner associations, which have arisen in part because of what some people would have us believe is smart growth, but what this is you're compacting people into ever smaller areas.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you are, in so doing, depopulating rural areas and semi-rural areas and creating urban communities where, frankly, none were originally thought to exist, and none did, in fact, exist. There are all sorts of political consequences from this because urban communities tend to be very left of center. And thus, if you can herd people through all sorts of rules, regulations, exorbitantly high prices for land and all this sort of thing, and herd them either into apartment complexes or condos or townhouses or what have you, raising the population density of what used to be suburban, which are now de facto urban communities, politically this is going to benefit one political party, and it doesn't take a tremendous amount of imagination to figure out which one that is, as we here in Northern Virginia have seen over the last several decades. So there is method to the madness. It doesn't mean that every homeowner member of homeowner association does this consciously or is even aware of it. But believe me, all of these people have a commonality of interest. And, you know, one hand is washing the other here. And if you have people who are intent upon, you know, smart growth, there's ultimately a political agenda that's in play here, one that goes way beyond your particular homeowner association. And the interlocking relationships between homeowners associations, local elected officials, all sorts of people who benefit financially from smart growth, and this can be real estate developers who go in and buy property in areas such as, well, where you are, Fairfax County, where I am, Arlington, and what have you, and they then promote projects that serve their interest. We had an example here in Arlington, and to the amazement of everyone, we actually stopped it. But the powers that be in Arlington County, Virginia, wanted to build a streetcar that would run from roughly the Pentagon, which is very close to Potomac River, west into Fairfax County. Well, cui bono? Who benefits from this? Very simple. First of all, the construction company that would lay the track and be involved in constructing both the line itself as well as the producers of the trolley cars, the unionized drivers of the trolley cars, but also, and this is the important part of this, the real estate developers who say, aha, there's going to be, in place of buses, which, let's face it, are not that sexy, we have very sleek, glistening streetcars, and that's going to bring new business to certain parts of town. And that means we can stash in, we can build more apartment complexes, more condo buildings, drive up, which will ultimately drive up the price of real estate there, because they will come in and buy the properties, and the properties that are there now, the one- and two-story buildings, get leveled and are replaced by multi-story buildings.
Yeah.
And the whole character of a community has changed, and we're told that this is something good. Well, it is good for a certain percentage of the population, those who benefit from this. But believe me, it's not good for anybody else, because housing becomes less and less affordable, forcing people to be driven back out even further. But then once they get out, they find out that birth prices are astronomically high out there, too. So it's a rigged game. Now, interestingly, we stopped that here in Arlington. It has something to do with the fact that North Arlington is relatively affluent, and the people here realize that they wouldn't benefit from this. South Arlington, where the streetcar was supposed to go, is less affluent. And people in North Arlington said, look, we would be paying for this thing. We wouldn't be benefiting from it. And it was killed. It was a very good thing. So this was a smart growth idea that had been around, talked about for 10, 15, 20 years in one of the most left-of-center counties in the face of the planet, Arlington, where I live. And yet we actually managed to stop it, and we stopped it simply because it was so outlandishly expensive, and it was something that we knew we couldn't afford, and it was something we would be pouring money, being the county residents and the taxpayers, would be pouring money into. We would probably never once take a ride on the silly trolley, and it was pointed out by many people that you can have these natural gas-powered buses that can take people from point A to point B, which also are much more flexible because they can go where the tracks aren't, whereas the trolley can just go where the tracks are. So this is something encouraging, and I think our listeners should know you can stand up and you can fight and you can win even when the deck is stacked heavily against you, as it certainly was initially in Arlington County, because the county board here wanted this. The people with money wanted this, the people who stood to benefit from it, yet we killed it. We killed it because it was so outrageous, and it was so stupid that not even they could go along with it.
I'm glad to hear that. I know that you have been involved in stopping some of the lunacy that's gone on in this state, not just in Arlington County, and I want to get to that in a little bit. But when you talk about, you know, the term smart growth is something that the proponents of shunting people in cheek to jowl are calling it, because everything's in the language, isn't it, Bonner?
It sounds pretty. Oh, yeah.
It's smart growth. You know, a lot of people would think that that's an absolutely ridiculous term, and it's really quite stupid, because you just don't get that elbow room anymore. You're getting piled on top of each other. There's no place, you know, the people, the EPA, the water people, there's no place for the runoff. There's everything is replaced by concrete and asphalt. And
that's true. And actually, you're leading to more congestion, because you're compacting people and automobiles, buses, delivery trucks, every vehicle that's out there. And you're compacting them into progressively smaller and smaller and smaller areas, which leads to the very congestion they would have you believe that smart growth is going to take care of. No, smart growth actually leads to more congestion.
Yes.
It leads to higher prices for people to live, whether they're renting an apartment or buying a townhouse or a condo. I can assure you, where I live, the price of real estate is astronomically high.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough to have purchased my condo 15 years ago. It is that the same condo now would cost almost three times the price in 15 years. It's about two and three quarters what I paid for it in 2000. Now, that it far exceeds the rate of inflation, but that is ultimately a reflection, first of all, of the phony economy of Washington, D.C., which exists by expropriating money from taxpayers around the country and passing it out to well-connected government contractors and subcontractors here, and the people who feed off the great Washington, D.C. cookie monster. but it's also a result of patterns that are related to smart growth, the compacting. I mean, if you just look around you, tall buildings are shooting up everywhere. Well, there's only so much space here, and so that the only place they can build is up. So build yeah. up they do.
Yeah. I had someone from the Urban Land Institute on shortly after 9-1-1, and I said, are we going to start rethinking all these tall towers? And he said, well, maybe, maybe not. But if you look at where we once had parking lots,
gone.
They're gone. They're replaced by entire villages.
I know. Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
A friend of mine was in town not long ago, and she and I wanted to go to a very good Vietnamese restaurant in Arlington, and we gave up. There was no place to park.
Yeah.
Because the parking lot behind the restaurant is now a condo building.
Yeah.
Oh, there's another one down here. Oh, no, they're putting up an apartment house there. So in one sense, they are forcing you to take public transportation.
Yes.
Because if you do away with parking lots and you make it almost humanly impossible to find a parking space anywhere, then of course they herd you like cattle into public transportation. But what if you don't want to do that? What if you really want to get in your car and drive around? If you're in the Washington area and you're down in the metro, well, you don't really get to see what's going on up in the streets. Well, from your car, you can look it out and you can say, hey, there's a new restaurant over there. There's something over there. So it's another example of where all of this has led. Now, there's a fascinating article in today's Washington Post. If anybody, you can go online and get it, or you can try the hard copy if you can get it. It's on page one, and it's about an absolutely bizarre consequence of the emphasis on constructing ever taller buildings. And this, the example is in New York City, but it's not just in New York, it's elsewhere, that these high-end, I mean super high-end condo buildings in New York are getting so high that they are now blocking the sunlight from getting to Central Park and to other parts of New York City. So what used to be relatively open and where people, and I guess we've all been to New York, and it's actually it's a great walking town. You walk around there. Well, now, even when the sun's out, there's not a cloud in the sky. In many parts of the city, particularly in Manhattan, you're walking in shadows. And these tall buildings are blocking all of this. So I'm sure all these people who live in these tall buildings say, well, I think it's great because they have fabulous views. But what about the poor devils down the street,
or
the people who want to go have lunch in Central Park and enjoy a beautiful warm spring day like today? But they're going to be sitting in the shadows of all of these gigantic, and these are not office towers as much as they are condominium buildings. In New York City, but these things are taller than the Empire State Building. I mean, that's how gigantic they are. So what they're really doing is they are transforming urban landscapes and making them actually more unlivable, less people-friendly than they were 20 or 30 years ago. Now, obviously, the people who construct these buildings are making an enormous amount of money. They're making out like bandits. Well, that's good for them. But look where these policies, openly encouraged by people such as the mayor of New York and his predecessor, Mr. Bloomberg, but look where all this is really leading, that you're actually creating a much unfriendlier aesthetic environment than what previously existed, all in the name of providing a minuscule percentage of the population with fairly spectacular views, but more importantly to our conversation, all in the name of what these people would have us believe is smart growth.
It's, you know, some years ago, there was a lot of talk about the environment and clean air, and you need trees, basically, to sort of cleanse the air a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And the idiot who happens to be my congressman, Jerry Conley,
Oh, yes.
Oh, I adore that man. He came up with something. Well, that's okay. We can just tear everything out and we can build these buildings. And what we'll do is we'll plant trees on rooftops.
On rooftops. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's very fashionable. Right.
Do you remember that?
Oh, I remember that. And, of course, there are places here in the Washington area, but also in New York and elsewhere, where they are putting trees on rooftops. Well, I don't really object to their putting a tree on a rooftop, but I would really much prefer to have trees down below. But one of the problems they're going to encounter with these buildings that get taller and taller and taller that block out the sunlight is the trees are not going to get enough sunlight to grow. So we all like, those of us who live in more or less urban environments, we all like to see, particularly this time of year, the trees turning green after spring blossoms. You go out and you look at them, and, oh, that's great. You know, winter's gone, and for the next few months, we're going to see a lot of green. Well, that's fine, except that if we keep going the way we're going, and if we follow what is going on in New York, in Toronto, in Chicago, and in other places where they're building these gigantic buildings, you are going to make it impossible for trees to grow in certain parts of the city. And if anybody thinks you're going to be able to offset that aesthetically by putting the trees on top of the buildings, I mean, what planet are you living on? Because who is actually going to be on the roof seeing the trees?
The planet that Connelly lives on is the planet
of idiots. Oh, yes. You don't even want to think about it. Yes.
No, I cannot stand the man. But I want to go back to where we started when we opened the show, and we talked about the middle classes and terrible schools, which brings me down to the children. Why are we raising children in tall towers? We have all kinds of problems, obesity, we have diabetes, we have all kinds of diseases that are associated with the inability to exercise, you know, our more sedentary lifestyle.
Right.
And yet we're putting families and children in these tiny, minuscule boxes stacked one on top of the other, way up in the sky. What is this doing to the children? What is it doing for their upbringing and their ability to go out and let off some steam and run around and kick a ball and get dirty and play in a puddle without having the EPA come running after them for disturbing some kind of a microorganism that might have been alive in the puddle? I mean, it's crazy, Bonner.
It is. In the condo building I live in, which is not even that tall by modern standards, it's 18 floors, but I do see children. I see parents with children. They vary 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years of age, walking around, riding elevators up and down. And you see, when one of them has a birthday, we have a nice party room downstairs. There's a birthday party down there. But I wonder, my God, I remember where I grew up and how I grew up. We're probably somewhat similar to where you and many of our listeners did. Well, we had a backyard. I grew up in Atlanta near a creek. So we had snakes back there. We had ticks. I was fortunate enough not to get Lyme disease, but that's not because the ticks didn't try to give it to me. And we had dogs that wandered around back there, and we got pine cone fights and crabapple fights, and, you know, we went out and romped and, you know, did everything children are supposed to do. Well, I wonder, where do these kids play? Well, yes, I know there's a park. Well, how do you get to the park? Well, you can get in your car. And you can drive over to a park or a dog park or something like that. But as you get older in life and you reflect back on your childhood, you do remember how incredibly lucky we were. Not that we appreciated it at the time, because children don't appreciate anything when it's going on. They take it all for granted.
Yeah.
But thinking back on it, how lucky we were to have had all of that space in our backyard. Our little lot in Atlanta was 75 feet wide, but it was about 200 feet deep, so we had a huge backyard. And so we could romp around back there, play baseball, football, whatever it was, and have a great time. Well, for so many kids today, that world is something that their parents or their grandparents or whatever can tell them about, but they never experience it.
Yeah.
And I think the loss here is absolutely enormous because we're moving in the direction of more communal living. I mentioned at the birthday party that's thrown in our party room downstairs when some toddler turns 5 or 6. Well, that's great. They sing happy birthday, and the kids are all sitting at the table eating the birthday cake and all that. Well, in the world that we knew, we would go to Bobby's house or Susie's house or whatever when somebody had a birthday party, and the moms used to enjoy inviting the neighborhood kids in for the birthday party. This world is gone, and the kids today who are growing up in these urban centers have no clue what they missed out on. And it's a real shame, because believe me, it's not better than what it replaced, because I remember what that was. I don't idealize it, but I remember what it was. And I see now what these kids have as their options when they get home from school and they're loaded with energy and they want to play and they want to have a good time, and they don't have something. It's not like I did, walk out the back door. Oh, no. It's blocks and blocks away. And so rather than having more choices today, kids actually have fewer choices. And ultimately, and sadly, that's by design.
The kids in high-rises, you described that perfectly, but the kids in associations as well. There seems to be a war on cars, and there seems to be a war on kids, and it's all coming down basically to social engineering.
Oh, it is, right.
They're changing the way we live, and I'm not sure that it's for the better, as you said, and I'm certainly not sure that it's a healthier lifestyle.
It's not, and there's an interesting consequence of that. If you start restricting a child's choices, and if you get children at an early age programmed so that they expect to be restricted in their movement,
yes,
it's going to be a lot easier,
yeah,
to control them later in life, which is ultimately what much of this is all about. You, first of all, put them in abominable public schools, starting off with, in some cases, with Project Head Start, which has been around for decades and has accomplished absolutely nothing other than provide employment for the people in Project Head Start. But the kids haven't benefited from it at all. So you take them off to public schools, which I would say are bad by design. You miseducate them, you indoctrinate them. Then when they come home from schools, they find themselves restricted in their choices and where and how to play. So they grow up thinking, well, I can't do this and I can't do that. They're going to be much more malleable politically and in every other way to do what a tiny elite wants them to do. In other words, we're forming these people. Not you, not I, and probably not our listeners, but the people calling the shots are actually turning out robots and calling them children. And you get these people used to being told what they can and can't do. You know, in the old Eastern Bloc countries, the Soviet Union, they tried very much the same thing, that they would indoctrinate the children from early on. And of course, the economies that they put up there were so disastrous that people really had no choice to do much of anything. And they tried, and in some cases sadly succeeded, in turning out people who simply got used to doing what they were told to do, and people who are kindred spirits of the people who ran the Eastern Bloc and the old Soviet Union. People who are their kindred spirits are now the people such as the aforementioned Congressman Connolly, the people in the homeowners associations, the board of supervisors at whatever Northern Virginia county you care to mention. And these people, whether they really fully grasp what they're doing, and many, some of them do and some of them don't, but ultimately they're all part of a structure that is turning more and more of us into meek, submissive people who simply go along to get along and who grow up with not the thought of challenging the status quo.
Before the collapse of the Soviet Union, I remember reading an article by Ayn Rand who lamented the fact that if the Soviet Union went, we would have an entire generation who had never made a decision for themselves. And she was really terrified. She was really afraid that they would not be able to survive. They had always been told what to eat, when to get up, when to go to bed, what to study, what to wear, you know, the whole thing, never having had to make a decision. Well, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, a lot of Russians emigrated, and a lot of them ended up in America, many of them in Chicago, many of them in condominiums and cooperatives in some of these high-rises. And I remember interviewing one of the attorneys who represented the associations, and he told me that the biggest problem they had was with the Russians because they refused to recognize the authority of the association. So I thought, you know, maybe there's a silver lining there. Maybe they think, you know, we've been under somebody's thumb all our lives. You're not going to tell me what color to paint my front door. I refuse to recognize your authority to do that. Go away.
These Russian immigrants had, as the expression goes, been there and done that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And wait a minute, I've seen this before.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't come all the way over here just to be introduced into a new version of what I just left.
Absolutely. So that always gives me just a little ray of hope that maybe, just maybe, there's, you know, it's not going to be quite as bad as I imagine it
to
be.
Oh, yeah.
But I feel so bad for the kids. Feel bad for the kids.
Because they don't know what they're missing out on. They have no clue. Yeah.
Well, it's always, I wonder, you know, these kids are going to grow up thinking, is this the way we're supposed to live? I mean, when they come home with their parents and their parents are afraid of answering the door, answering the phone, getting the mail, is this really the way we're supposed to live? And the answer is no.
No, it's not. But it's sadly the way that an awful lot of people have become used to living. And most people, unlike our Russian friends in Chicago and elsewhere.
I love that. I keep remembering
that. No, that is
that.
Funny. I'm delighted to hear that. But unlike them, a lot of people, you know, go along to get along. And they're knuckling under. And sadly, I fear that in those parts of the country where this is pretty far along, and you and I live, you in Fairfax County and I in Arlington, and we are living in a world where, as I said, we're being directed to live life a certain way by people we rarely ever see, unless it happens to be a member of a homeowner association, when maybe a slip comes under your door that you have violated, you know, blah, blah, or blah. And you know, pick the criminal offense that you have just committed. But it's very sad. But people need to wake up and realize what's going on, and that all of this is being done in the name of, well, this is the rational way to do all of this. We have limited space, and therefore, all of these various living and working arrangements that are now being forced upon us. Well, this is really the best way to do this. Well, I would contend it's not the best way. Having seen other ways of doing this, what you ultimately see is a system that's becoming more dysfunctional all along. One of the reasons the middle class in this country, and particularly in certain parts of this country, is having such a difficult time, is that simply the cost of housing has gone up exponentially. And one of the reasons it's gone up exponentially is because of certain land use policies that are in effect all around the country means that certain land is off limits to build.
Yeah.
Well, the less land there is, the higher the cost of the dwelling, whether it's an apartment, condo, co-op, house, townhouse, or what have you. And, of course, that's very good for real estate people, but it's not really good for anybody else. And so this is a problem which is actually much bigger than people realize, because it not only gets into your property rights, but it gets into your rights as a citizen, that you find yourself, well, you're supposed to be living in a free country, which turns out, well, maybe it's not all that free after all. Yeah, because your betters, the people who want to, who will have you believe, well, we're protecting the environment, and we're protecting open space, we're doing all this, that, and the other. Well, they're actually, first of all, assigning an awful lot of power to themselves. Secondly, they're lining the pockets of people who benefit from the system. And believe me, there are people who are doing very well.
Oh, yeah.
Developers, real estate people, people like, believe me, the good times are rolling for them. But they're not rolling for the rest of us. And if you just get the exorbitant cost of housing in certain areas, and you combine that with a public school system, which is dysfunctional, which means that a lot of people, if they really want their kids to be well educated, and they don't have the opportunity to homeschool them, then they're going to have to send them to private schools, which are themselves terribly expensive. Once they get the kids through private schools, then if the child so wishes, go to college. Well, that turns out to be a giant, you know, unfortunately, higher education in this country is now a gigantic clip joint. And what this means is we are paying incredible amounts of money for education, for college education, the tuition and the cost of living in a dormitory and what have you, have skyrocketed over the past several decades far beyond the national rate of inflation, again, because of government policies that provide, for instance, student loans to kids. Well, what does that tell you if you're at an administrator of a university? You can go ahead and jack up the tuition because somebody else is going to pick up part of the tab for the kid who's coming to college. I mean, who hasn't figured that one out? And so you have a middle class that finds itself increasingly on the receiving end of housing and land use policies which raise the cost of living. They confronted again with the public school system, which is increasingly dysfunctional, and I would argue dysfunctional by design, and then a higher education system, which A, in many cases is not all that high, and B, is so exorbitantly expensive that kids come out of college today owning, I believe the average figure is something like $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt, and it's not uncommon for kids to start off, you're 22, 23 years of age, and you're already $100,000 in the hole. And it will take a month of Sundays before you crawl out of that debt. And two generations ago, or even a generation ago, there was no such thing as student debt. It didn't happen. You worked your way through school. You can't do that today.
You can't. I did not go to school in this country, and when I came here and my daughter went through, I was absolutely shocked at how bad the education really was and how little she knew when she graduated from high school.
Oh, yes. That's exactly right. And the quality has deteriorated over the years. And I am convinced that in 20 or 30 years, it's going to be infinitely worse than what your daughter was exposed to when she went. And
I can't imagine it being any worse than it was.
I can't either. You figure they must have bottomed out. But again, nobody cares because the teachers themselves are subject to the peculiar rules and regulations of the teachers' unions. And the establishment is the public school establishment is simply interested in lining their pockets as much as they possibly can, and in miseducating the children as much as they possibly can. And again, a child who comes out of high school, not being able to speak proper English, who can either add, subtract, multiply, or divide. I mean, there are plenty of examples of kids who have difficulty reading their own diplomas, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
It's that bad.
Yeah.
And this does not have to be, but that is the system we are stuck with today. And everywhere you have government sticking its hands into, I mean, these are, let's face it, these, we call them public schools. They're actually government schools. But the federal government having a huge role in all of this, which is ultimately where the trouble began when we federalized the public school system here. But you now have state and local governments complicit in the whole thing because they have bureaucracies, they have administrative people on staff whose salaries have to be paid, and yeah. So you have gigantic education bureaucracies.
There's no pride in
none whatever,
getting a job done. Butter, would you believe we are out of time?
Well, it's been a lot of fun.
I hope you'll come back.
I would love to.
Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.